Welcome everyone to another episode of the House of Wisdom podcast, where we interview academic influencers about their research and how it can shape the world. I am Deepak Bauer, an academic.
And I'm Annie Carmid, Deepak's estranged friend for this episode.
Something's happened, right? Between the two of us.
I mean, I just don't like you anymore, Deepak.
How are we going to go forward now?
Let's just get straight to the episode.
Let's not talk anymore. Let's not have any pitter-patter. Let's just get straight into the episode. But before we do, Happy New Year to everyone. Hopefully this new year, 2021, brings a bit more positivity into this world. 2020 is behind us, which I think everyone can agree is really good. And yeah, looking forward to 2021. Let's see what happens.
Definitely agree with that, Deepak. Let's get on with the episode.
All right, then. Welcome, everyone, to another interview installment of the House of Wisdom podcast. In this episode, we have Professor Guido Hernandez joining us. So Professor Guido Hernandez is a professor of public international law at the Catholic University of Leuven and the Open University of the Netherlands. Previously, he was a reader in public international law at Durham Law School and deputy director of the Durham Global Policy Institute. He's the author of The International Court of Justice and the Judicial Function and International Law books. Guido took a doctorate of philosophy from Wadham College, Oxford, and read for LLM degrees at Leiden University and BCL and LLB degrees at McGill University. Prior to his academic career, Guido served as a law clerk at the International Court of Justice in The Hague and was called to the Bureau de Quebec and practiced as a barrister at Fasken Martineau LLP. Guido, it's a great pleasure to have you on. How are you feeling?
I'm very well, thank you, Deepak, and thank you for that fulsome and generous introduction.
Brilliant. And also, I just want to mention, the last time we talked, I think you were the one interviewing me, let's say. It's quite nice to maybe just flip the roles this time around.
Yes, indeed. Well, I was examining your PhD. So I think in this sense, there's a certain poetic justice in me being called into the House of Wisdom today.
I think so. Brilliant. Okay, so we should just start off with the light art questions and then we'll go into the more substantive elements after that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, Professor, if you were stuck in the House of Wisdom, who would you want to be stuck with?
I've had to give this a bit of thought because as you originally phrased it, I'd be stuck there for a number of months, right? So I narrowed it down to two people and for completely different reasons. One of them is Pablo Picasso. Why? Because he's a completely different person than I am. I had some time when I was a student wandering around Europe. I went to the Picasso Museum and spent some time learning about the man and his art. And not being an artist myself, it's the sort of creative work that I find mind-blowing. But more than that, he sounded like a very interesting man, liked his wine, women, and songs, someone to spend time with. And I think someone like that would challenge me, honestly. Lawyers tend to be a button-down group. We tend to be quite serious sometimes, quite earnest. Someone like Picasso would probably, push my boundaries a little bit if we were stuck together for a few months. But the other one is probably more conventional, and that's Nelson Mandela. And he's probably one that would be very popular with your listeners. But I've got a specific reason for doing that. And it is in reading some of his work, not actually involved in his biography. Mandela always preached democracy, reconciliation, and humanity. And there came a time when he was imprisoned, where he had to call on violence. He had to resort to violence in order to promote his agenda. He justified this in a rather elegant piece where he explained that when you are met with intolerance, at some point you must rise up. And he did. And the world changed as a result. 8 years later, this man steps down as the president of South Africa. He could have stayed for life. He could have ridden his legend to the end of his days. And yet he understood somewhere that power could corrupt. And that for the good of his nation, he had to step down. And I'm perhaps more vain. I'd probably want to stay in power my whole life. So frankly speaking, I wonder how a man like that could, have the courage to stand aside from his life's work and to watch natural processes resume. There's a certain admiration I have for him on that specific point. And of course, everything else that he fought so hard for. But that specific point, I've always been intrigued. I always wanted to ask him in person.
I think someone who has full control over themselves and has full awareness can realize that I don't need this power to feel complete. I think that is a really amazing person who has that full awareness.
Indeed.
Also, on a more light-hearted tone, I'd be a bit concerned about having Picasso in the House of Wisdom just for maintenance reasons. Just because if he got a flash of inspiration and he's just ruined the place. And for me, I think I would choose Mandela. Mandela was actually one of those inspirational figures that I came across, especially during my undergraduate studies. It was someone that we actually studied quite a fair bit in my law school. So I was always fascinated with his work. And I think I would love to have someone like Mandela and talk to him about his struggles and the way he, you know, fought on and you know, thought about kind of his principles and how his principles really did drive his decision-making, his choices, and how much of a profound change he really had. I also heard that he was actually quite a fond advocate of international law. So that'd be also great too. So then it'd be a great conversation because he'd definitely be willing to have that chat about the international legal system. So I think there's a lot of reasons why I would choose Mandela maybe over Picasso, although I would say Picasso would be pretty crazy. So that would be a pretty wild few months if you hadn't. So then moving on to the second question. So Anik and I thought that some of our previous guests had added some really good additions or good little elements to the House of Wisdom. So we had Professor Philippa Webb, mm-hmm. Who added a home cinema, which we thought was great. And then our first guest, Professor Andres Witter, he thought he'd invite Aristotle. So me and Anik thought, so say Aristotle maybe got stuck in the House of Wisdom, has been wandering around for a while. And Guido, you came in and you've just realized, oh, he's been stuck in there. You've got a home cinema. And you thought, okay, actually, I wouldn't mind showing him a bit of film or a bit of, you know, entertainment to show him what the world is like now. What would the choice be in terms of the film or TV series, let's say, that you'd say, okay, this is what the world is like. This is the introduction to the world we're in right now.
Thanks, Deepak. On that question, I had to deliberate also from a personal perspective. As the father to a four-year-old and a two-year-old, my attention span is increasingly limited to something below 60 minutes a night, or my capacity for cultural consumption, shall we say. But one of the shows that has most marked me, and I think we live in a golden age of television right now, and there's a lot of good quality stuff that provokes thought and provokes reflection in a way that has not always been the case, or at least wasn't the case when I was young. But the show that's marked me the most is Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale that's been transformed into a series with Elizabeth Moss. And I think that's the show that I would want to show Aristotle. Why? Not specifically to do with Aristotle, but rather as a warning of the world in which we can live in. We live in this postmodern world, post-truth world, where everything can be relative and challenged and contested. And yet, amidst all of that, tyranny can arise. And I think Handmaid's Tale, besides being a really compelling emotional story of what happens when the oppressors take power, I think is also a cautionary tale about how fragile our societies are, our liberties are, and how easy it is to take them for granted. Specifically, I mean, I'm originally Canadian, so perhaps there's a North American-centric perspective there, but I could see a world in which some of those features could have figured. And if we look at the recent election results, I guess those on my side of the political divide sighed a bit of relief that maybe we took one step away from that possible dystopia. So that's what I'd show Aristotle.
Yeah, I think it'd be a good kind of warning of kind of the world that we could live in. And I agree with you, Guy, in terms of, like, I think entertainment, especially like, I'd say like science fiction and a little bit more of those fantastical genres are really a great, we've talked about this actually quite a few times, quite a good uh-huh. indicator of where the world is going and the direction the world is taking. And I think, you know, Handmaid's Tale, something I've actually wanted to watch for quite a while, but never got around to it. And I've heard very good things about it. So Glyd, I think I might take you up on that.
It's very suggestion. Depressing, but it's definitely worth it. Definitely makes you reflect.
Yeah, so, and we also started thinking about it a little bit too. So me and Anik were like, actually, what would we then show to Aristotle? And I initially thought I'd be a cynic and show him Idiocracy and show the world that we're living in. But then I thought maybe that's a bit too harsh. And I thought maybe something about Barry Jenkins, something like Moonlight or If Beale Street Could Talk, just showing maybe the full palette of the world that we're living in. So the struggles, the difficulties, but also, you know, the love in the world, the more positive ideas in the world. So I would maybe choose something like Barry Jenkins to show, okay, this is what the world that we're living in is like. Anik, what was your choice? I remember you had quite an interesting take.
I've changed my mind quite a few times, and I've changed it in the last 10 minutes as well. So I probably would show him the first season of a show called Altered Carbon. It's on Netflix. I won't give any spoilers, but the concept is that you can live forever because you're able to transfer your consciousness to different bodies. Mm-hmm. So if you have that concept in your mind, how would that change his thinking about philosophy, life and death? Because I think philosophy is inherently bound by the parameters that we have a finite life. And as soon as you take that restriction off, what would happen to his thinking in particular? So I'd be interested to see how he would react to that concept and how does that change his way of thinking about life.
Some really interesting thoughts.
I think we could definitely have a nice kind of movie night with Aristotle.
We could have a movie night with him, yeah.
Brilliant. So let's now move on to the more substantive elements of this interview. So December 2020 was the five-year anniversary of the Paris Agreement, which at the time was seen as a significant moment for tackling the environmental issues that could devastate our world in the not-so-distant future. In a slight change of tone, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on governments to declare a state of emergency, or let's say a state of climate emergency, when speaking at the opening of the virtual summit to mark 5 years since the Paris climate deal was signed. GLIDA's recent work on climate litigation has seen academics bind together to consider how international law can be used to tackle rising global temperatures. Furthermore, GLIDA's work on international legal theory has also questioned and helped us to consider the role of the international legal scholar and whether or not they should contribute to social or political change. So GLIDA, so first of all, we want to really just discuss the aspect of climate change litigation. Could you perhaps just give us a little bit of a summary or a short summary of your research in this area of international law?
Certainly. Let's see. Where do we begin? I mean, this is an exciting new avenue. And I confess that it's very much in the stage of design, reflection, and brainstorming amongst myself and a small group of colleagues. We've been observing a couple of things. So first of all, as you said, a part of my research is relatively theoretical. I look at authority structures and the way that law is made, not in form, but rather in substance by powerful actors, actors like judges, but also international civil servants and indeed academics. And a lot of my theoretical research is focused on how scholars create structures that are then reproduced throughout the profession in practice and thus hold informal but substantial power. It's in that light that I recently became involved with a non-governmental organization, a group called the Global Legal Action Network. Little shout out there. But GLAN has been strategically employing practitioners and lawyers and academics in order to take on cases that are high profile, high visibility, and have the potential to be disruptive in the active pursuit of challenging societal injustice. And the way in which it does it, which I think is quite unique, has been to focus on those areas that are not only activist friendly, but also potentially theoretically interesting. One of the cases has been to bring a European Human Rights Court case on young children accusing 33 member states, to the Convention on Human Rights on climate prevention. And they've taken a human rights approach. In my work with GLAN, I've begun developing the conceptual foundations for an interstate claim. So a claim that would involve two nation states or potentially one of the organs of the United Nations, probably the General Assembly, asking the International Court of Justice to give an opinion on the nature, scope, and content of climate change obligations by states. Why? For a couple of reasons. One, we think that this is an area that requires some sort of judicial intervention. Right now, the impetus remains political. It remains policy focused. And the role of law, which I think can be potentially very powerful, is underexplored, underspecified, and not sufficiently clear. We think, and this is perhaps the point of strategic litigation, we think that by provoking judicial institutions, lawmaking institutions, to give their interpretation, to try to make sense and to structure what's out there, they can do so with greater authority than academics, who often have their own agenda. They can do so in a concrete sense, because here they are faced with a concrete question relating to a specified set of facts and perhaps a number of actors involved that is a little bit more concrete. In this sense, we think that they can weigh in on the debate, perhaps reframe the debate, and inject a little bit of legal clarity in an area that needs it rather sorely. So over the last couple of years, I've been involved with a young team of researchers. We are trying to explore, on the one hand, a relatively practical project. What role can law bring to these types of disputes? But also a little bit more blue sky thinking about how we can enter into dialogue with other professionals, not only legal practitioners or international civil servants, but also climatologists, marine biologists, atmospheric scientists, and other areas in which we're simply not dialoguing with each other on the international plane. Most interdisciplinary discourse takes place domestically. And there's been, I think, a paucity of reflected dialogue on that global scale that is both academic and somewhat activist. And in this, I must say, for this specific project, I've embraced an activist posture, and I've done so very consciously because climate change is really a matter that requires global collective action.
Just following on from that, Professor, you know, we've just passed the 5th year anniversary of the Paris Agreement, and I already know your answer, but it would be good for you to elaborate a little bit. How successful do you think the Paris Agreement has been in committing countries to tackle climate change?
Do I think the Paris Agreement has been successful? No. It is not preventing climate change in and of itself, but it is successful in other ways. And I think these ways are important and need to be taken into account. One of the ways is that it has refocused attention on the necessity to combat climate change. When Trump withdrew the United States from the accord, it was seen as scandalous by all other states that had signed on. This was an agreement that succeeded by being universal, even if insufficient. Yes, it does not set binding targets that can be enforced through traditional legal forms of dispute resolution. That is true. It doesn't fit the classical paradigm that lawyers like to see. But it has innovated in other respects. It has innovated in setting up, ratcheting up mechanisms that are automatic, in using public pressure to induce states to meet their obligations. It has created procedures through which states reform their practices and reform their reporting and transparency requirements in order to be more visible. In this respect, no, it is not a traditional legal instrument. It is inherently a compromise. But we are beginning to see glimmers of hope in the way that, for example, the European Union continually raises its ambition. Even Brexit Britain has committed to a higher level of ambition than it had even 5 years ago. And it's showing off that it has a higher ambition to reduce by 68% versus the 55% promised by the European Union. Now it can afford to do so. It's a highly industrialized state. The EU has states like Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary that are disproportionately dependent on coal because of their industrial history. Sure. So no, the Paris Agreement is not enough. Law is certainly not enough, but it is a part of the discourse. And for that reason, it is relevant. Do we need to reform it? Yes, continually. Are there lessons to be learned from it? Yes. In that sense, it has been a positive contribution.
And I would agree with you in terms of certainly there's a lot of questions to be directed towards the kind of success of the Paris Agreement, but certainly we can see that it's putting a little bit more pressure on states to be a bit more active about the issue and about the topic. But what's kind of interesting and pleasing for me to see is that international lawyers aren't waiting around for states to deal with it with just the Paris Agreement. The research that you're doing here is actually saying, let's make a concerted effort to guide, let's say, non-governmental organizations, even states, other international lawyers to think about how can we use international law to tackle the issue of climate change. I would like to maybe just go into a little bit more in terms of the techniques and approaches that you introduced or suggested in the two blogs. I just want to cover that and think about, you know, how can we use the ICJ? How can we use the international legal provisions that we have right now to make that effective impact on the issue of climate change with, you know, the international legal community doing that rather than relying upon states to do that?
Okay, A couple of things. So the first point that I think merits scholarly examination at this stage is that to date, most of the efforts that are being done in respect of litigating climate change, making climate change law, as it were, a thing, have evolved using a rights-based discourse for climate prevention. So a human rights claim claiming that climate change is impacting on the right to health, the right to a sustainable future, the right to bodily integrity, that kind of stuff. We have a couple of objections to this. The first one is it hews too closely to a classical paradigm that law intervenes when there's been an injury. So first year torts, folks. We don't think that that's satisfactory for a number of reasons. One of them is the complexity of man-made climate change. Humankind has contributed to the change in our atmosphere, not through one dramatic breach, one large factory being built, but rather billions and trillions of micro emissions that take place every time we throw something out without recycling it, every time we drive our car, every time we take a flight, et cetera, et cetera. Science is decades ahead of the law in this respect. And so although a rights-based dialogue can create visibility, it can make a difference in forcing courts to specify these rights, we don't think it goes that far enough. We think that alongside it, you also need approaches that are less, well, first of all, anthropocentric, so less fixated on human rights, on human needs and human benefits, but also taking into account that the scientific consensus is not that climate change hurts human beings. It is that climate change is destroying the earth. It is attacking ecosystems. It is attacking global climactic stability. And it is a threat for all life, not just for human life. So we're trying to break free from that. The second one is actually quite pragmatic. It is that climate obligations have not been structured in terms of obligations only towards citizens, but rather also as obligations between sovereign states towards themselves and perhaps vertically towards a nebulous international community. We think that also having the principal court of the United Nations, so the principal judicial organ, if you make it long, we think having it weigh in will lend a different method and a different interpretation to these norms, one that can work alongside other efforts in human rights courts or in domestic courts indeed, or even in trade disputes, et cetera, to further push this along. Now, is it the most effective step? Perhaps not. But I'm a lawyer and I'm a lawyer by training. And it is here where I can lend my expertise to societal activism. And so the path I've chosen is not to retrain as a climate activist, but rather to use the knowledge of law that I have and apply it in service of what I think ultimately is a desirable goal. And I make that claim, if I may, very explicitly. This is not a claim that climate change and climate justice are objective truths and everyone must agree with us. I am far too postmodern by training to accept that sort of claim, and I'm not a universalist when it comes to ethics and morals. But that said, this is a choice. This is one of those moments where I've chosen to abandon a purely critical posture and to use the tools that are existing through the positive law in order to see if we can make a difference. Is that the difference that everyone ought to see? I don't know, but it's something that I can live with. And I think that's an important nuance and maybe goes into the second part of our discussion well.
And would you say the current structure or design of international law is not fit to address a problem like climate change? And you referenced a little bit in your articles or blogs about the concept of no harm and trying to use that as a way to create some type of responsibility or consequences for to help states address climate change.
It's a big question, Anik. I mean, is international law unfit? Perhaps in its present state. But is law or international law as a concept inherently unfit to combat climate change? I don't think so. I have hope there. And I have hope in the potential of the law to adapt and to vehicle itself as an agent for social change. And I think this is a particular case where we can do that. part of our project, part of what I'm trying to do, is to highlight the pinch points where perhaps a legal claim would fail, and then to devise creative solutions by exposing the alternatives, to open it up to those who are in a position of power, to then look at those alternatives, look at the consequences of their choices, and perhaps, just perhaps, nudge the law along a bit. I see law as inherently elastic. I see law as the expression of political choices made by decision makers. Those decision makers are the ones that have chosen the outcomes that we end up with. By making that process a little bit more transparent, I think we can bring a practical perspective to that political process, which becomes the law. Yes, there is a strong claim to be made that lawyers should be focused on legal technique, legal practice, coming up with the correct outcomes as in the law themselves. And I think there's value in that. And I know that within our profession, that's probably the orthodox view or the mainstream view of what a lawyer should do. But I also think that it obscures the relationship between law and politics. All law is an expression of political choices. And I think in this particular area, we can show that. We can show that climate justice, as it were, is counterbalanced by concerns over sovereignty, by concerns over autonomy, by concerns over economic development, by the social choices that are made by every state. And nothing makes that more evident than the veering in and out of the Paris Agreement of the US government under these last three presidents.
So perhaps this is the best way to maybe go into that second part of the interview, but still make reference to climate change litigation, but also look at the role of the international legal scholar. Is it to be socially active, to be politically active? I think both myself and you guys have both kind of discussed or looked at the fact that the mainstream theory of B positivism is to strictly focus on law, to focus on the legal mechanisms and not to look at the political, economic or sociological impacts of international law. You're certainly arguing otherwise. You're saying we have a responsibility. We've got the knowledge to utilize international law to make social change, to make political change. Is this something that needs to be discussed a little bit more? And what's your take on that aspect?
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Deepak. I think this is a really nice way to segue into a broader discussion about why I'm doing what I'm doing and what other scholars are doing as well. I would say a couple of things in response to your question, which I think has a number it's got a number of layers that I want to drill down into. The first one is, I think that all lawyers need to understand how the law operates in practice. Without understanding how the law operates in practice, we don't make sense of what the object of our cognition, the object of our study. It's one thing to challenge the law for being racist or gendered or imperial or colonial, but you need to show it. And very often the evidence is right there in the positive law itself. Again, law is the expression of political choices. But to that I would add, and this is where I think an activist lawyering is, or not activist lawyering per se, but rather the identification of activist lawyering matters, is that I do not believe the positive international lawyer when they say they are simply interpreting and applying the law. I think that that itself is a political choice. It's a commitment to the status quo. And I don't have any problems with the politics or ethics behind that choice. They are simply not mine. I believe that when we engage with law as scholars, we are helping to shape the world's understanding of that. We are producing knowledge for it. And sometimes that knowledge for knowledge's sake is sufficient. And certainly, I must say, in most of my scholarship, it suffices. I do not see the role of scholarship, I must make clear, I do not see it to be activist. What I do see is the potential for scholarship to be overtly activist. And I'm much more comfortable with the scholar who says, I am a scholar. My professional engagement is the production of knowledge to the highest standards to withstand scrutiny from other scholars. I have no problem with that. I do have a problem with someone saying that, but in fact producing scholarship that only serves certain political purposes, does not state the foundations behind that conviction, and does not substantiate it. I prefer when the scholar takes their work and says, this can have practical impact. Here's how, and here's why, and here is my desired end state, and justifies that, perhaps by an appeal outside the law. So an appeal to ethics, an appeal to morality, an appeal to politics. It's much more justifiable for me for the scholar to put on another hat than to pretend that their hat is one of activism. So I think in short, and I realize my answer is perhaps quite convoluted, I don't think that all scholars make law. I do think that, however, that all of our methodological postures are inherently a matter of choice, a matter of political choice, and that they can generate real world outcomes. And as such, I think what I'm calling for is for academics to take on a more conscious sense of responsibility for the law that we study, to take responsibility for the limits that we identify, to expose them, and to send them back to those who have the power to change it, if that makes sense.
No. I'm certainly on the camp, on the latter, one of the descriptions you mentioned about doing theory, making it very clear how this has an impact on some real world structure and showing me how we can do that in a very specific way. I had this discussion, I have these discussions quite often with Deepak, and it was one of the things that we talked about during his preparation of his Vibe. I read his thesis. I thought it was really interesting, but the main question I had was, so what? You know, here's your ideas about using law to create a utopian society. But it's just all theory right now, Deepak. How do we move this forward? And I think this is one of my grudges that I have against academia, is that we're writing a lot of theory, then we're going on to teach other people about this theory, and you have a little loop where the way you stay in job is by teaching other people about this very niche piece of research, but then it never sees the light of day, or it never translates into something that you know, the real world can use. What do you think about that?
Well, as it happens, I have a number of thoughts on the relevance of theory. Let me see if I can address your question directly, and also respectfully, because I think there's an important subtext to what you're saying that merits, I think, a full response. And I think our views are not as divergent as they might seem at first glance. The first one is, why engage with theory in the first place? I don't think it's for everyone. I don't think everyone should have to. However, I do think that society has to leave room, and I think that room is classically understood as existing within universities, where people can be left the freedom to think rigorously and fully about the world that we live in, to create knowledge for knowledge's sake, because we do not know when that knowledge might become relevant. And let me put it this way. The UK academic system is driven by a certain marketization, a certain productivity. A lot of proxies are used for the production of knowledge and its impact on real-world society within the UK societal order, shall we say. I didn't want to call it the legal order because that's too lawyerly. The problem with that, I think, is it's short-termism. Sometimes knowledge becomes relevant in ways that we don't understand 10, 20, 50 years down the line. And I think it behoves us as societies to maintain institutions where some of this thinking can take place. It's not going to take place in private policy think tanks, which are focused on short-term solutions. It's not going to take place in corporations where people are not paid to do that. But I do think that if there is an institutional role for universities in the 21st century society, it's that some scholarship should not be required to justify its immediate societal impact for non-experts. Ideas can change the world. Sometimes they don't, but sometimes they might. And on that, this leads me to my second point, which is the relationship to theory to practice. And there, I have some affinity with you in that sometimes you find academic debates that become very self-referential, very sterile. And I hope that I don't engage in that kind of discourse, although inevitably, sometimes we adopt the vocabulary of those that we're trying to relate to, and we cite to the same authors, and we presume a certain received knowledge. But ultimately, I think if we take that too far, and I try to remain conscious of this, we forget the role of theory and what it is in our world. And I think the role of theory is to try to capture reality in its fullest way. It is to try to understand the world that we live in, the place of human beings within that world, and the universe more broadly. And so that sounds very grand. But by that, all I mean is reflections from theoretical physics or from quantum physics. We would not have had the imagination to think, for example, so I don't know if you two are familiar with string theory, but string theory is, in short, the idea that matter can be in two places at the same time, that it oscillates. And that's the whole field of quantum physics. In order to get there, we need to have people to have the creativity to suggest it as a hypothesis and then to test it. And I believe that with law, as an inherently social discipline, the study of something that humans have by and large created, so if you exclude natural law theory for a minute, then we need scholars to do more than just tell us what the law says. We need scholars to show us how history brought us to the point that we are. We need scholars to show us the consequences of these political choices expressed in law on economics, on society, on politics, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We need scholars to situate the law in other fields of knowledge. And I'm not saying that all of us have to do it. In fact, I'm not even saying that that many of us need to do it. But I do think that they help all legal scholars, all legal practitioners to understand the world if it's done well. So in my own teaching about theory, I try to balance between pushing the classics, pushing disruptive thinking, but also trying to bring it back to an audience where I presume that most of my students would like to go on and qualify at the bar and practice the law. I want to give them the analytical tools so that they can look at a treaty and they don't just fixate on its text, but they actually think seriously about what alternatives might have been available to them, why the treaty reads the way it does, and what consequences it will have. Because, and I, from my previous incarnation as a practitioner, a lot of what we did with the law was in service to politics. It was in service to the politics of our client or to the worldview of our judge, if you're clerking for a court. Ultimately, you are not just telling them this is what the law says. You're telling them this is what the law allows you to do. And that is not a legal interpretation. That is the interface between law and something outside law. So that's where I think theory matters. That's why I teach it and I enjoy teaching it. It also challenges my assumptions every day about what the law says, why it says what it does. Because often, how do you say, it's not that the words of children are always the truth or something like that, but rather sometimes my students studying a classic text for the first time will have the most original insights that deeply challenge my way of approaching that. So that's why I particularly enjoy teaching theoretical as well as more doctrinal topics.
I feel like my justification for theoretical research very much lines up with how you've just argued it. So I often tell a lot of students that theory is a tool to help us argue, discuss and analyze society or the world more accurately. So theory allows us to unlock what is happening around us and why it is happening around us. So that's kind of the tool that I see theoretical research to be. My concern is perhaps it operates too much in a vacuum, within that academic vacuum. And these kind of tools are not given out or not branching out to the wider community. And I think my question to you is, do international legal theorists or do theorists in general or academics who work in the theoretical field need to interact a little bit more, need to communicate their work a little bit better so that for the likes of someone like Anik who says, well, you know, in my day-to-day workings, I don't see the need for theory, they understand, okay, this is something I can use when I'm making a decision, or even when people are having discussions and debates, that they are a little bit more aware of how and the way in which they are discussing topics.
Thanks, Deepak. I think you make a fair point when you say that theorists can become self-referential, almost pretentious about their detachment from the concrete world. And that is not a nice tendency in academia, but I liken it, and I say this as well as somebody who not that long ago was also a junior scholar trying to make my way, stabilize my career, and all of these things that we look for. So we look for originality, we look for a way a way to claim expertise on something. And I think that's a temptation of any scholar. And it has to do with the sociology of academia and the sociology of law schools and the entire academic university system. And I think it is a forgivable temptation. But I do think we need to escape it for a number of reasons. One of them is exactly as you suggest. Theory helps us to make sense of the world. It helps us to understand why things are the way they are. And good theory pushes us in that direction. It illuminates the corners of our understanding. In that light, I think there are a couple of things that need to happen. One of them is, I think theorists, in order to be more ambitious, have to become more modest. We don't have to fall prey to the temptation that intelligibility is a sign of our success. So I don't think that theorists should pivot and start speaking to popular audiences in order to push their own personal brand, if that makes sense. I do think, however, that academics and scholars don't exist in a vacuum, and that as part of our engagement, we need to take seriously not only the students that we teach, but the fact that our students are citizens within a wider society. And how can I put this in a manner that's succinct and not too circular? We need to stop teaching theory just because we're interested in it. And we need to see the teaching of theory as a way to get our students and the general public interested in why we're interested in it, even if they're not willing to go all along the line and start reasoning and reading the same texts as we do. I think the mission of theory is to maintain, or the mission of theorists in law is to maintain the relevance of studying the foundations of law. And even if that influence is only indirect on practitioners, and I think ultimately it is, you're not going to negotiate a tax treaty between two states and refer to grand theories of David Kennedy or Susan Marks. But that said, you may be referring to economic theories. You may be referring to distributional theories. You may be referring to theories of justice in terms of the redistributive effects of your tax treaty. You just don't do so by name. So the role of the theorist, I think, is to make sure that the next generation of students comes out equipped with those analytical tools, even if they don't use the vocabulary of a Foucault or a Deleuze or a Derrida. And at the same time, you need to continue to reflect and challenge your own suppositions. A theorist should never become a brand. We should remain curious, agnostic, and open to what others are thinking, rather than become someone who is selling their own theory, who's trying to make their theory relevant. That's when identity and knowledge become intertwined in a way that I find unpleasant. So if it makes sense at all, I just think the theorists need to be more responsive to the world that we live in, but without succumbing to the pressure to be out there all the time and to constantly be changing what we do to please other people.
I do value theory. I think Deepak was a bit strong saying I don't think theory is relevant at all. I think, and this is purely anecdotal, I do think academics have spent a lot of time studying books and studying about structures, having never worked in those structures. And I think having an appreciation of how the actual mechanics work helps you address things like, and move away from just saying concepts like institutional racism. Because I've had many debates with people who study it. And once you actually go into the structures that create these incentives, these people find it very hard to pinpoint where it happens. And I can tell you, I can go through a bank, I could tell you where incentives are created for people that during the recession, why they, how they took people's money, how they used it recklessly and how that created a crisis within banks. But the kind of theoretical research focuses on such a big concept that it doesn't help anyone understand how it actually happened. Do you think there is that missing gap between theories and practice? And do you think we could do something about that to improve how theory is kind of branded, I suppose, from my perspective anyway?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's a question to Deepak as well. You know, I do say to him, you're studying these structures. You haven't obviously worked in them yet. Hopefully you will one day or have some experience. How does that inform the way you do research when you've never worked in these structures, but you're commenting and you're criticizing how they work?
I have two things to say about this, and one of them is purely biographical. We all follow our paths to build our careers, and we make choices, and those choices shape us in turn. And two of the choices that I made were to make sure I was a fully qualified barrister back home in Canada before pursuing my postgraduate studies. And so I spent years summering in law firms, and then my year at bar school, which I did not like, and then practicing for about a year before taking off to do my PhD. And I broke that up with an LLM. That shaped me. That taught me how to work under pressure. It taught me how to apply the law in very specific contexts, how to respond to a client, in other words. And I think that was quite foundational in understanding the power of law for me. The second moment in which I entered into practice, I spent some time at the ICJ, the International Court of Justice. I spent almost 4 years there advising two judges and participating in a number of judgments being drafted. And I saw basically the application of theory to practice. And I saw the way that parties formulated their arguments when they would use more conceptual or theoretical claims. And I think it's important to drill down and not just say there is theory, but even doctrine is a theory. So for example, does the right to self-defense extinguish itself after your territory has been occupied by another state for a period of time? This was a recent debate on one of the scholarly blogs, and it is an eminently practical question, but ultimately it comes down to a conceptual understanding of the doctrine of self-defense and its roots in a more conceptual notion still, which is that of necessity. And the idea that certain things become necessary, such as breaking the law or using violence, even that practical question is theoretical and has great practical implications if you think, for example, of the situation of Northern Cyprus, or of the Palestinians, or of Artsakh/Nagorno-Karabakh. All of these situations, real world examples, where if you don't understand the conceptual foundations of the law, you may get it wrong. But not only will you get it wrong, you may misunderstand how the law is useful in that case. So I would argue that maybe that's one way in which we need to break free of the dichotomy between theory and practice. And that's to stop labeling it as such, and to have scholars like me who are interested in theory, not identify ourselves as legal theorists, but rather as legal scholars, simply. And that we are interested in certain questions, and maybe they're a bit esoteric at times, but ultimately they do have a link to reality. And that brings me to the second point. And it relates to how you talked about the 2008 financial crisis and what measures were taken within that. And it reminds me of some interesting work that's been undertaken. I won't start name dropping because we're running out of time a little bit as well. But very often, new law is made in crisis. New law is made in situations where the existing law runs out and we don't know what to do. So we fumble for solutions. And where do we find these solutions? Very often in theory. Look at the most recent UK government. It has been faced with this rupture with the European Union. And that rupture has created, I wouldn't say a conceptual vacuum, but rather it has created the room for new choices as to what kind of state the UK will be, what kind of legal order it will have. What has happened? Government has reached out and found conceptual ideas and frameworks that suit its political objectives. And it is retrofitting that theory in order to suit its objectives. So the referendum was won, and sovereignty became this newly specified instantiation of political choices. And now what is that leading to? To the overthrow of the European Court of Justice. So very practically speaking, we have notions of popular sovereignty overriding consent to jurisdiction by an international court. And that's being facilitated by a government which has reached out to academics to pull out theories from the dustbin of history in order to make them relevant to justify their choices. I've chosen that example because it is an example which your readership might be comfortable with. But at the same time, this happens all over the world. It happened, for example, when states were trying to justify slavery and basically started pulling out all sorts of pseudoscience relating to race theory and evolutionary biology to justify their position, to justify the institution that was already there. We also find it in situations where we want to blow countries up in order to protect human rights. We develop theories of justice that go all the way back to St. Augustine to justify so-called just war theory and to renew concepts of using violence to take lives, using violence in the service of a just cause all the time. Theory doesn't necessarily create the impetus, but it justifies the political choices being made. Sorry if that was a slightly circuitous way to get to the answer, but hopefully we got there in the end.
No, we certainly did. And I suppose I will wrap up the interview by kind of responding to Anik and probably consider a little bit more just kind of the role of the academic and also maybe the role of this podcast to a certain degree too. So I think the theorist shouldn't try to wear two hats at one point. I think rather than try to maybe have that experience in the practical world, actually look for collaboration, not to just work in that vacuum of academic work and theoretical research, but actually branch out and talk to a practitioner rather than have the personal experiences and practical experiences themselves. More collaboration from two specific roles being conducted 100%, I think, is perhaps more effective in coming and bridging that gap between practice and theory. So I think that's my perspective, and that's perhaps why, for me, this podcast is so important, because it's a way of actually trying to bridge that gap and try to have people listen in, discuss, and think about the role of researchers, of academic work, of theoretical work, and for the more practical-minded people to think about, actually, maybe I should consider theoretical research a little bit more in my inner workings, or even just to be a little bit more aware of theoretical research and its impact. So for me, it's more on the lines of let the academic be the academic, let the practitioner be the practitioner, let's have a conversation instead of rather than having, you know, the practitioner try to be an academic and the academic trying to be a practitioner. Let's have two specific roles, we collaborate together, and that's going to perhaps be more effective than we're trying to be, you know, a jack of all trades, let's say. I think perhaps this is the best way to wrap it up. And I'd just finally like to say, Professor Hernandez, it's been a huge pleasure, and thank you very much for your time. And I thoroughly enjoyed this interview. I wish we could have gone on for 2-3 hours, but obviously we do want to keep it within the time limit of an hour.
Yeah, I think your audience would be thankful that we don't let it spread out for 2-3 hours in the end. Well, to both of you, it's been an absolute pleasure to come and speak. I really enjoy being able to move outside the classroom or the academic setting and just speak a bit more freely about what we do and why we do it. And in that sense, I guess it goes to your final thought, which is, you know, about theorists having to engage with others and having to give up the labels of being a theorist or being a practitioner or being a skeptic or being a cynic or being an idealist. And that we just have to remember that in the end, we're all engaged in the same universe, the same physical world, the same social world. And ultimately, all of us can make different contributions, and there's no point in disparaging any which one. Rather, we just need to kind of respect that diversity of approaches.
And I think we've definitely gone against the idea of removing labels, as we've created a new label called being an academic influencer, which we think you definitely fit that label, Glider. So thanks a lot.
Oh dear, I need to update my Instagram now.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
And on that note, it's been a pleasure. Take care, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. So that was the episode with Professor Glider Hernandez on climate change litigation and theoretical research. So for me, this was quite an important interview to have just for my own personal development. I'm an international legal theorist. So I think you heard in the interview, Glider was one of my examiners for a PhD. And for me, this was actually really important in terms of just identifying the importance of research and actually understanding how I justify and how I argue the impact and influence of research on the wider public. So, you know, this was really important for me. This is really key for me, and also for the podcast, because I think we're, you know, definitely this podcast is directed by that idea of being practical, having academic influences that are directly changing the world, let's say. And sometimes I don't know if the right word is overlooking or undervaluing theoretical research in this podcast, but maybe we are a little bit more scrutinizing of theoretical research, if that makes sense. So I think this was a really important episode in terms of discussing that and maybe challenging and putting it out there in terms of the questions. I think, any, especially you were quite upfront, like, what's important to research? Why should I listen to someone that's never practiced? I think that's why this was such an important interview, not only for just kind of the progression of the podcast, but for academics to listen to, for the wider community, for the wider public who aren't really in the kind of academic circles, to understand why theoretical research that's been taking place in the various fields is really important and really key.
Yeah, I really like the conversation with Claudia. I think I left with a lot more positivity in respect of the role of the researcher. I may come across as someone who's, you know, full on about being in practice and how that is the main way to make a difference, but I left with a much greater appreciation, and in particular the point Glider made about, you know, these researchers are yes working in an abstract, but they have the opportunity to test all these different type of hypotheses without, let's say, influence from the actual framework in the world, and they can be original and they can try things which only they can think of because they haven't got that frame of reference of being in those practice or being in those structures. And I think that does potentially help reach new ways of making change. I still think, though, academics and researchers would benefit from a better understanding of those structures that they research. And I think it would move them from having general statements to maybe more specific changes that someone could pick up in those institutions and go, actually, I can see how this researcher's work can directly change things. I think also, I mean, from your perspective, Deepak, did you leave thinking, actually, there's maybe one or two things that I could take away to improve the way I do research in the future? And, you know, you're someone who's just starting in your career and, you know, you've got a lot ahead of you. Did you leave with any kind of idea or?
I wouldn't say in terms of kind of the way I would look at research would change necessarily. I don't think that's the case. I think I've always kind of wanted to be a little bit more accessible in my research and have an eye on the practical world. But I think for me, what was really important, because I think this is something that is always discussed and there's always this kind of negativity around theoretical research, is, you know, why is it important? And for me, that's really an important discussion to have, an exploration of why theoretical research is so important. So personally, in terms of kind of the approach I take to research, I don't know. I think it definitely emboldens me and makes me more passionate and more inspired. I think this was definitely an inspiring episode to kind of continue on with theoretical research. But more than anything, it really helps me think about how I would argue the impact and influence of researchers or the way we do our research. So in that sense, that's why this episode on a personal level is really key for that kind of level of development. And although I think Glider's done a really good job in really justifying the whole aspect of theoretical research and why maybe researchers or theoretical researchers work in the confines of the university setting or the academic setting, and that's really important. I think, you know, one takeaway that you really enjoyed, that little bite-sized quote, was, you know, this research may have impact now, it might not, it may have an impact in the future, we don't know. It's important that we do that research, which is great, but I will still rally to the idea that we should, I include myself in that bracket of kind of international legal theorists, we should interact a little bit more with the wider public, with the general community. I think I made mention of the fact that we're, you know, providing tools to understand the world around us. Sometimes I think we kind of just are too happy to just work within our own little bubble. I think it's really key. I think something I would, for example, say, there is a conversation about Brexit, let's say. Good example, let's say Brexit. And the way in which it was discussed, I think certainly we'd criticize that. Maybe the impact that theoretical research could have had on that discussion, on that conversation, could have been actually really valuable in terms of giving them the right tools to then have a meaningful conversation and not have these two opposites that just didn't understand or weren't willing to talk about the issue in a kind of meaningful and thorough manner. I think so in my sense, I think theoretical researchers, yes, by all means, I think I agree, work in that bubble, develop your work, you know, explore knowledge, you know, go as wide as you can and understand how we can look at the world around us and develop these theories, develop these ideas. But I do think there is a little bit of responsibility for theoretical researchers, for those legal theorists, for those economic theorists, or for those political theorists to then engage with the wider community. So they are given those tools, and those tools can be quite useful and effective in challenging what's going on in the world or how we talk about certain topics and concepts.
It's a really good example, the Brexit case, when you had two political parties effectively using facts in a certain way to deliver their campaign. Mm-hmm. And would we have benefited from a knowledge platform of some type that was just giving us the facts about our relationship with the EU, what we can do, what we can't do, in a very objective manner, and helping us as a public become more informed before the politicians were using all this content to persuade us to vote for either one of them. So I can definitely see the benefit of academics playing a greater role in those scenarios. And you know, Glider mentioned that, you know, like theorists shouldn't try to build their own personal brands. And I totally agree with that. I mean, you know, you need to stay objective and you don't really want to become bigger than the research you're doing. But I will use the example of Brian Cox, who, I mean, maybe slightly different to the conversation we've had today about international legal theories, but he has taken something that is typically very complicated and he has simplified it in a way that most people can try to at least engage with and understand. And, you know, 10, 15 years ago, climate change was something still being debated, or at least in the public sphere. Maybe scientists were very clear at that stage. There was a clear link between human induced emissions and heating of the planet. But he certainly, through his time on TV, through TV shows, radio, lectures across the UK and even the world, he's simplified it for us and helped us as the public become more informed of climate change, so that when the politicians are using this as a way to make us vote for them, we feel more informed about who we should vote for. And I think that can only be a positive, I think, for society in general. So I'm definitely supportive of your kind of suggestion of you guys moving slightly out of your vacuum, mm-hmm. maybe having your own platform to tell facts in a more objective manner.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, what's the point of doing all this work and developing these ideas if it just functions within that bubble? I think what I'm just suggesting is let's just kind of move out of there. And, you know, we see students regularly talk about things that they are, you know, in complete contrast with each other, but they're able to talk about it and understand each other's viewpoints and develop some sort of consensus. So why shouldn't we, you know, academics who've kind of been trained, who've been training in this way of thinking, give out these approaches, give out these tools, suggest these kind of ways of having conversations about important political topics, important legal economic topics, and in that same manner. So I think for me, it's just a cry out to those legal theorists, to those various theorists from the various disciplines, you know, engage a little bit, because I think it could really help not only establish our importance in the, you know, wider societal landscape, but also just helps the conversation be directed in a more positive way. Final thing about Glider, I think Glider's the kind of person I could listen to for like hours. So if he wanted a bit of a side job as like an audiobook narrator, I think he'd do a really good job, because I honestly, like, he could just go for a while and just discuss these things. He's got such an amazing way of talking about topics, whatever it is, from, you know, talk about The Handmaid's Tale to, you know, climate litigation or some really deep international legal theory. He's such a great guy to listen to. So, you know, if Glider has an interest in like a side job, I think a narrating audiobooks would be great for him.
I'll just add one thing, Deepak. He was a great communicator. The way he kind of simplified these very, very complex topics, for someone like myself, as well, not coming from the background that you guys were, it allowed me to engage in the conversation with both of you. And that's really hard to do.
Yeah.
And obviously an expert at doing that.
I think his greatest achievement is that he you know, he got you on his side. Because obviously for someone that's, I sometimes maybe pigeonhole you a little bit in terms of, oh, I don't care about theoretical research or whatever. But I think he did a really good job of turning and thinking, actually, do you know what? Research is quite important. Actually, we do need to have some attention on it. So I think that's probably a huge victory for him in terms of just making you see a little bit more the importance of theoretical research if done correctly.
100%. Yeah, I'm not as bad as you suggest, but I'm definitely skeptical. I appreciate research. You know, I've done my undergrad, I've done my master's. I can, all the stuff that I've learned were the outcome of people researching, right? Trying to understand the way the world works. And I benefited from that during my undergrad and my master's courses. And I was then able to go use that in the real world, or at least the skills. I definitely see the benefit. I think my skepticism comes from reading a lot during those years, talking to a lot of academics, a lot of people in that world, and drawing a very familiar trend, which was, you know, a lot of these people aren't kind of pushing their research to the edge. It's theoretical research and it stays as theoretical research, which I think is a shame, because I think yourself and a lot of people, you're coming up with fantastic ideas and you're stopping there. And for me, I'm all about, I want to see outcomes. And so when you're stopping a theory, it's very hard for me to kind of relate to. But I equally understand 100% the argument Glider and even yourself presented. You know, this is important. Sometimes you're gonna, like we say in business, sometimes you're gonna reach unicorn status, and sometimes you're not. But you have to do it to see if you can break some barriers and make change. So I'm definitely supportive, and I think the way you've described it, I'm supportive of research that is done in a good way, and that helps bridge that gap. Yeah. Research in isolation, just to teach other people about the research in some endless loop, I'm not sure how valuable that is to anyone.
Yeah. I hope this doesn't scare future guests or potential guests, because I think that's kind of an important question we should ask, and we should kind of just say to academic influencers, why is your research important? Obviously in the nicest way possible. We don't want to make anyone feel bad, but I think it's important.
I'm generally not this bad. Perceive me as. I think this is exactly why we both came together, to discuss big ideas, discuss how we can push research or academic research further, and draw the links between people's work and what's happening in the real world. And I think whoever wants to come on this show would love that. And I think all the guests that have come so far, fortunately, I haven't heard anyone say anything negative about my questions in particular.
Yeah. No, I don't think so. Everyone's been really positive. We've really been quite grateful for the way guests have really got involved. All right, let's wrap this up. So Twitter, House of Wisdom Podcast, How Ideas Can Shape the World. Look out for the OWL logo. Instagram, House of Wisdom Podcast. Check us out on the various streaming platforms that Anik always has a giggle at when I'm giving out the endless list. Spotify, Apple, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Anchor, all those things, all those places. Google Podcasts. Check us out on there. Support us. So like us on Twitter, like us on Instagram, or follow us, whatever it is, you know, just support us, because that's really important for us to kind of branch out and develop a bit more.
And I will add to the viewers, we are a 5-star rated podcast currently. I'm not going to tell you about the number of reviews, but as it stands, we're rated 5 stars.
Yep. So keep adding to it, add more 5 stars. It's going to look better for us. So really important that consistency continues on in terms of 5-star ratings. All right. There's always one last thing. There's always kind of one way to wrap up the end of this episode. What have you got for me, Anik?
I always tend to use quotes from movies. This time it's not directly from a movie, but I've been inspired by A Theory of Everything. And of course, that's based on the life of Stephen Hawking. And one thing he said, which I think is really, really relevant to the interview and the topic today. He said, "Quiet people have the loudest minds." See you next time.